You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Russian internet trolls have been using fake social media accounts to stoke division in America. Two researchers tell us why happy, uplifting posts have become a big part of online misinformation strategy. First, the U.S. war in Afghanistan started in 2001 after the attacks on September 11th. It continues to this day. It's sometimes called a forever war, and after nearly two decades, it holds the title of the longest-running armed conflict in American history. Now, in a new bombshell investigation, the Washington Post has uncovered thousands of previously secret documents and interviews showing senior U.S. officials have knowingly misled the public for years about the progress being made in the war and the chances for success. Craig Whitlock is an investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He's the reporter behind its investigation into what are being called the Afghanistan Papers. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about what it took to get these records and what these records are in the first place?
Sure. So these records are interviews with more than 400 people who played a direct role in the war at all levels, from generals and ambassadors and White House officials down to aid workers or military troops in the field. These interviews were conducted by an obscure government agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan as part of a lessons learned project, they called it. But they suppressed most all of the findings in the interviews, and we tried to obtain them under the Freedom of Information Act, but it took us more than 3 years and two lawsuits in federal court before we were able to obtain all these documents.
And what you do in your reporting on this in many cases is to stack side by side what officials were saying behind the scenes in these reports and what they were saying publicly. What did you find when you compared and contrasted?
Well, I think people remember the public talking points of the war have been pretty consistent all along. Commanders in the field, presidents at the White House, secretaries of state have always said, well, it's a tough fight. There's challenges, but we're making progress. They would always say we're making progress. The strategy is sound. We're moving in the right direction. And yet in these interviews, in very raw terms, many of those same people and other senior U.S. leaders were describing their own strategy as a disaster, saying that they fundamentally didn't understand Afghanistan. Their plans didn't make sense. There was a lot of infighting. In short, a completely different story from the line that was being fed to the public.
I want to listen to some of the audio you were able to obtain. First, Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor. He was also previously a military intelligence official, a lieutenant general. Here he is being interviewed by a government agency about problems in the war in Afghanistan.
Never mind, not accomplishing our mission, but the just severity of corruption in our own system, you know, I think is just unbelievable. And you know, I mean, the waste that I saw is unbelievable. And, you know, you sit there and just kind of go, you got to be kidding me. Why do we do this, you know?
And this is another recurring theme in your reporting on this. The United States put a lot of money, not just into the direct military effort, but into various kinds of aid and support in Afghanistan. And a common theme here is the corrupting influence that had. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the biggest problem with corruption really started to occur, I think, under the Obama administration during Obama's troop surge into Afghanistan, when he sent 100,000 troops there. There was a real rush to try and build up the Afghan government, build up the infrastructure in Afghanistan to essentially modernize a country at a really fast track, because Obama only wanted to keep U.S. troops there for, you know, at most a couple of years for this surge. So we've kind of flooded the country of Afghanistan with billions and billions of dollars. And in the interviews we obtained, people are saying they quite literally couldn't spend all the money they were required to, that there was no rhyme or reason to it. They were just under such pressure to show that they were spending money, it didn't matter what they were spending it on. And a lot of that money, directly and indirectly, ended up in people's pockets. And to this day, the corruption levels in the government of Afghanistan are, you know, a real drawback in the whole war itself, because the Afghan people see their own government as corrupt and are much less likely to fight for it.
Talking to Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at the Washington Post, talking about the Afghanistan papers, documents that they obtained in Freedom of Information Act, documents and interviews showing two messages, so one inside the U.S. military and diplomatic service of pessimism, one public message, more optimistic, highlighting progress they saw around the corner. Craig, wanted to talk about the clarity of mission here. This is another theme that keeps coming up. It's not clear to a lot of the principals here what American goals were in some ways from the beginning.
That's right. And I think to most Americans, they would, you know, that makes sense, right? What are we trying to accomplish in Afghanistan? People have a lot of questions about why we're there, what we're trying to do. But what was remarkable about these interviews is how the people in charge themselves wondered why we were there or said that the mission was muddled or murky. I think at the beginning of the war, people all understood why we invaded Afghanistan in 2001. It was in response to the 9/11 attacks, and it was to try and destroy al-Qaeda. But within 6 months or so, al-Qaeda's leaders had either been captured, killed, or had fled the country, like Osama bin Laden, who went to Pakistan. So we really eradicated al-Qaeda from Afghanistan early on. And in these interviews, people are saying that's when the mission changed. That's when the war changed. That's when it became unclear why we were still there. What were we trying to accomplish? Who was the enemy is even a phrase you hear time and again from people at the top, but also in the middle and in the field. They quite literally said, we weren't sure who we were fighting. Where are the bad guys? Show me the bad guys. That's what some of these people said. And you know, if you're in a war and you can't tell who the enemy is, you're probably in a difficult situation.
And you also got audio of Ryan Crocker, former ambassador to Afghanistan and Pakistan, talking about this. Even the good guys, the people on our side, were not morally crystal clear here. Here he is talking about a man named Fahim Khan, an official in the Afghan government. Quick warning to listeners, this may be disturbing to some.
He was giggling, and he proceeded to relate to us a mob had gotten out of control at the airport and had murdered the Minister of Civil Aviation. And he giggled while he related this.
Crocker goes on to say that reports later said Khan himself had this official killed. This is where former Ambassador Crocker picks up on that individual.
But I certainly came out of those opening months with the feeling that even by Afghan standards, I was in the presence of a totally evil person.
So this is how a U.S. official is describing somebody theoretically on our side, Craig.
Well, not just somebody on our side, but Mohammad Fahim Khan was vice president of Afghanistan and defense minister for years and years till he died in 2014. And this conversation that Ryan Crocker had with him was in 2002. Fahim Khan was a warlord from the northern part of Afghanistan, and his troops from the Northern Alliance worked with the CIA and the U.S. military to topple the Taliban. So they were a key military ally early on in the war. But as here's Ryan Crocker, who is our ambassador in Kabul, meeting this guy, Fahim Khan, who went on to become defense minister and vice president of Afghanistan, and describing him in kind of blood-curdling terms as a real evil person. Yes, so this is our ally, and this was a really problematic, fundamental issue with our whole presence in Afghanistan, who our friends were.
Another story you share was about corruption at the key Afghan bank. U.S.-backed investigators in Afghanistan were trying to crack down on corruption there. What happened when the Afghan government found out about that?
Well, there was the Kabul Bank was the biggest private bank in Afghanistan, and around 2010, it started to be a public run on the bank. People were worried that they couldn't cover their deposits, and people were literally lining up in the street. And there was a real concern that the whole bank would melt down. The problem was the U.S. government had helped support this bank indirectly, and yet the people who were in charge of it had been looting it with hundreds and millions of dollars of unsecured loans to themselves and their friends, including Fahim Khan, the warlord who was quoted as being evil. Rather than really push the Afghan government to prosecute people, the U.S. government in public kind of made a stink about it, but behind the scenes kind of backed off because the fraudsters in charge of the bank, again, were friends of the United States and leaders in the U.S. in the Afghan government. So it became kind of a politically untouchable situation.
We're talking to Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. We're talking about his reporting on the Afghanistan Papers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this story? Have you been following it? How does what you're hearing from officials' private interviews square with what you remember people saying in public through the war? And if you're a service member or veteran who has served there in Afghanistan or Iraq, for that matter, what does this story mean to you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Afghanistan Papers, a set of thousands of documents and interviews the Washington Post obtained after suing the federal government that show widespread confusion and dysfunction in the war in Afghanistan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does this story square with your feelings about the ongoing American war effort in Afghanistan? Do you see parallels between the war in Afghanistan and the Vietnam War? If you're a service member yourself or the loved one of a service member, what do you think when you hear this story? And do you have questions for our guest about his investigation? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have three quick questions. Number one, how many Americans have we lost in Afghanistan? Number two, how many dollars have we wasted in Afghanistan? And number three, why, after all these many years, can we not just leave?
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if you have numbers right in front of you, Craig.
Yeah, Tom has three good, succinct questions. So 2,300 U.S. troops have been killed in Afghanistan. More than 20,000 have been wounded during the war. That's, of course, a small number compared to the number of Afghans who have been killed. Overall, more than 150,000 people have died in this war. The United States has spent roughly about $1 trillion during the war. You know, we'll let other people decide if they think it was worth it or not. And the third question as to why can't we get out? Well, it's a lot harder to get out of war than it is to begin one. Right now, President Trump has directed the State Department to negotiate directly with the Taliban to try and cut some kind of deal to withdraw U.S. troops. He's the first president who has authorized direct negotiations with the Taliban. That was something that was always controversial during the Bush and Obama administrations.
Thanks for the call, Tom, at 800-642-1234, as we talked to Craig Whitlock from The Washington Post. Craig, an argument has been made that, okay, the initial mission, preventing al-Qaeda or something like it, from rising in Afghanistan that could target us here in the United States, that part of the mission has been successful. That makes it maybe worth a sustained troop presence. Is that a common argument you hear back to criticisms like Tom's, for example?
It's a very common argument. Military commanders make that all the time, that we need to stay in Afghanistan to make sure that it can no longer once again become a safe haven for al-Qaeda. And I think there's some merit to that argument, but I think there's also some things that don't add up to a lot of people. For one, we have to remember the 9/11 attacks. While Osama bin Laden was hiding out in Afghanistan, the planning for it and the preparations took place in Germany, in Hamburg, Germany, and then the hijackers came to the United States to train. These weren't Afghans who carried out the 9/11 attacks. They were mostly Saudi. Some of them had traveled to Afghanistan, but it wasn't that Afghanistan was really a base of operations for the 9/11 attacks themselves. The other thing is al-Qaeda has really spread around the world. For many years after 9/11, their base of operations were places like Pakistan or Yemen, Somalia, Syria, as well as Europe. So, you know, yes, if we keep troops in Afghanistan, that makes it less likely that a terrorist attack may be launched from there. But, you know, there's any number of other countries where terrorist groups can seek refuge. And, you know, to say that we would occupy them all militarily, of course, isn't feasible.
And Craig, you also rely on your reporting on another set of documents, memos from Donald Rumsfeld, at one point Secretary of Defense, early on in this war effort. He sent out what I think people called snowflakes. Is that right?
That's right. They're sort of memorably described as snowflakes because Rumsfeld would dictate so many of these memos, you know, dozens a day sometimes, that people in the Pentagon talked about how they would flutter down on their desks like snowflakes. He was a very brief writer and dictator memos. He would get right to the point. You know, I'll give you one example that some of these would really raise eyebrows when I first laid eyes on them. Rumsfeld in 2002, October 2002, he writes himself a memo about how he had gone to the White House to meet with President Bush to try and set up a meeting between Bush and two generals. One of the generals was Tommy Franks, who is the U.S. commander for Iraq and the Middle East. And then he told Bush, I want you to meet with another general, General McNeil. And according to the snowflake memo, Bush replied, well, who's General McNeil? And Rumsfeld said, well, he's the general in charge of Afghanistan. And Bush replied, well, I don't need to meet with him. So that says a lot, that first Bush is entirely focused on the coming invasion of Iraq several months later and completely oblivious as to who his commander in Afghanistan was. And again, this goes all the way back to 2002. But it shows at that time how the Bush administration was really focused on Iraq just, you know, a year after they had started in Afghanistan.
Talking to Craig Whitlock from The Washington Post about his investigation into what's being called the Afghanistan Papers, a bunch of documents, interviews and more with key principals in the American war and diplomatic effort there. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Oh, hi. As I mentioned to the screener, I'm a Vietnam vet, and basically we're seeing Vietnam all over again. A lot of us that were Vietnam vets when we started getting involved in Iraq and Afghanistan just kept saying this is going to be another Vietnam. We're going to get caught up in a quagmire. Actually, this has been going on longer than Vietnam. It's all based on misinformation, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin incident or invading a country like Iraq based on 9/11 and something they weren't even involved in. And basically it's just continuous lies and misdirection. And as far as keeping troops in Afghanistan, there's no reason to keep any troops in Afghanistan. We're talking about preventing the spread of terrorism or Al-Qaeda or whatever. But you're only covering such a minute part of the world that if you put 10,000 troops there and you think you're going to accomplish something, let's face it, they're just going to go somewhere else.
Michael, thanks for the call. Craig, a lot of people seeing echoes of Vietnam, I mean, all through the war in Afghanistan, as Michael has been saying. Do you see that?
Well, I do. And in fact, if you go back to late 2001, when the war started, this immediately became a question or a fear. Would we get stuck in another Vietnam? And President Bush was asked this, and he said directly, you know, no, we've learned our lessons from Vietnam. We're not going to get stuck in a war like that, like we did in Vietnam. And Rumsfeld, once at a press conference, he was mocking people for suggesting we might get stuck in a war like Vietnam. He said, all together now, quagmire. You know, he was mocking people for saying Afghanistan could turn into a quagmire. You know, of course, 18 years later, despite that hubris, you know, that's certainly exactly what happened.
Let's bring on another caller. Rich joins us in Portage. Rich, hello.
Hello there. I wanted to make two comments. Number one, it's along the line what you're just talking about, is this battle is war is you're trying to fight an ideology. It's hard to fight an ideology that's been entrenched for decades. Number two is you're using hindsight as judgment based from decisions that they have to make in battle. You have a luxury of hindsight. They don't have that.
Rich, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that second point first, Craig. We are looking back on a lot of these discussions and situations. They were trying to navigate it in the moment.
That's true, although actually the first part of Rich's questions about the ideology is I don't think we really know what we're fighting in those terms. Ironically, Osama bin Laden, when he launched the 9/11 attacks, exactly his goal was to drag the U.S. into a long, costly war in Afghanistan, just like the Soviet Union had done starting in 1979. And not long after that, of course, Soviet Union broke up. And, you know, bin Laden's biggest dream was that the United States would come to Afghanistan and get mired in this very costly, bloody war. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. It's hard to argue otherwise. So in terms of ideology, we kind of fell into his trap, and we're having a heck of a time getting out of it.
Rich, thanks a lot for that call. And staying with that first point that this was about ideology, if it had been just about ideology, it would have been way more simple. It was also about regional differences in Afghanistan, tribal differences, if we want to call them that, systems of patronage that had been there forever. It was way more complicated than just an ideology, right?
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, the Taliban, I think many of them, they see the United States as to lack a better description other than the cliche, but they see us as, you know, foreign infidels who have come to occupy their country. They're trying to expel us. They have a much different outlook on world affairs than Al-Qaeda does. But that's who we're fighting now, are Afghan insurgents and their allies from the region. But what's remarkable in these Afghanistan papers from these interviews is the number of senior leaders who are very blunt in saying, we didn't understand Afghanistan. We didn't have a fundamental idea of what we were doing there. General Douglas Lute, who is the war czar for both Bush and Obama in the White House, said we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking. And this was a guy who administratively was in charge of the war.
We'll leave it there for now. Craig, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. He was with us today to talk about the thousands of previously unseen documents he uncovered that show American officials talking in private about the war in Afghanistan and comparing and contrasting their pessimistic messages there with their more optimistic messages to the public. If you want to read the Afghanistan papers and find out more about the reporting that went into it, you can find the stories linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we'll find out why internet trolls from Russia and other countries have made positivity and uplifting messages big parts of their online strategy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we often hear the disturbing numbers about opioid overdoses and addiction in the United States. We'll get a more personal look at the impact through the eyes of a graduating class from a Midwestern high school. First, an inspiring story of an NFL player helping tackle poverty made the rounds on social media this summer. It got almost 300,000 likes on Twitter for a fake account run by Russian online misinformation agents. The efforts of the Russian government to deepen America's social divisions through fake internet accounts came to light during the 2016 presidential campaign, and those efforts continue today. Our next guests say that positive, even uplifting posts are a key part of those efforts to identify their audience and build a following. Darren Linville is an associate professor of communications at Clemson University, and Patrick Warren is an associate professor of economics at Clemson. They've been researching Russia's activity on social media for the past few years. They recently wrote about this for Rolling Stone magazine. Darren and Patrick, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Good to be here, Rob.
Well, Darren, let's start with you. When we think of a Russian internet troll, or when I do, I think of, you know, somebody coming on and raising a ruckus and making a hard time. You write that, no, it's way more subtle than that. Often it's innocuous, fun-sounding stuff they're sending. Why?
Well, Patrick and I have spent the past couple of years studying Russian tactics and strategy on social media to answer just that question. And it is not as straightforward as people might think. They often will tweet out innocuous, very heartwarming, happy tweets to get people's attention fundamentally. They often, they're building a brand. They're establishing who they are. They're trying to communicate within very particular communities. And once they've got your attention, and once that happy tweet has been retweeted to other people, they'll get followers, and that is going to, you know, allow them to communicate to a broader range of people.
And Patrick, can you give us an example of one of these positive posts that are kind of sweeteners for these Russian accounts?
Yeah. Generally, they'll find a post that's already started to go viral in some other subcategory. So an example might be there was a tweet about Michelle Obama, that she was the most educated and
highly educated. She had degrees from Harvard and Yale.
The most highly educated first lady ever, and we should celebrate that. And we should. You know, we should celebrate that. But that's an example of the sorts of message they would send in order to try to pick up followers.
And then with – go ahead.
Sorry, the double-edged sword about that Michelle Obama tweet that makes them particularly tricky is that when they're celebrating Michelle Obama, at the same time, they're subtly denigrating other first ladies who maybe aren't so well-educated.
And that makes it sound, Darren, like they're cultivating, the Russian hackers or trolls are cultivating different audiences that they're going to send different messages to.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We've seen them communicate within, you know, the Black Lives Matter community quite effectively. They talk to MAGA America. They have accounts targeting LGBTQ communities, Blue Lives Matter conversations. They're very focused in who they're trying to reach, and they target these communities in order to push them in more extreme directions, and also. What's really frustrating is they target these communities in order to get them to be disgusted and more angry at the other ideological perspectives. So, you know, they create these divisions between the Black Lives Matter community and the Blue Lives Matter community and deepen them and entrench them.
And Patrick, I think it's important to emphasize, we're talking in the present tense here. A lot of people might think this was a 2016 story and then it was done. This is going on right now?
Absolutely. So just a couple months back, Facebook shut down about 50 accounts on Instagram. We've been talking, our work is mostly about Twitter, but they shut down about 50 accounts on Instagram that were pursuing this exact same strategy. And they attributed those to also emanating from Russia.
So what is the long game here, Darren? What do the Internet Research Agency or its successors want in these campaigns?
They want to divide us. They want to make us disgusted at one another. And the more we become disgusted at one another, the harder it is to compromise. The harder it is to govern our nation. The harder it is to move any agenda forward, whether it's on the left or right. As Patrick and I like to say, the more we're talking about what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border, we're also not talking about what's happening on the Russian-Ukrainian border. The more divided we are, the better it is for Putin.
Patrick, when we're talking about us here, this is the United States. Are we the only country that's targeted by these Russian agencies?
Absolutely not. If you look back at the 2015, 16, 17 campaign, we found examples of accounts that targeted the U.S., Canada, Germany, Italy, Spain,
France, Egypt. Yeah.
And there's certainly no reason to expect that – again, I know most about that campaign. There's no reason to expect that stopped. There's a NATO strategic communication group that studies carefully Russian disinformation in Europe, and they continue to find numerous examples of these sorts of attacks in Europe as well.
I would add, too, it's not just Russia doing this on an international scale. It's also Iran, Venezuela, China. There's more and more state-affiliated actors in this space. Just recently, we spoke to the Wall Street Journal about a campaign that China was directing at the NBA, targeting Daryl Morey, the general manager of the Houston Rockets, who had the audacity to say something positive about democracy, specifically about democracy in Hong Kong. And the Chinese were able to create 1,000 brand new accounts on Twitter every day for a week. And the first thing each of those accounts did was tweet something awful at Daryl Morey. That's just an incredible undertaking.
Talking to Daryl Linville and Patrick Warren from Clemson University, looking at international social media influence efforts, especially from Russia, targeting countries like the United States and others around the world. Let's talk about what we can do about it. And let's start off as individuals, Darren. We're sitting at our computer or on our phone or whatever. How can we be more careful to make sure we're not helping a foreign influence campaign spread divisive messages?
Sure. It's very hard. You know, we've been doing this, looking at disinformation for a couple of years, and it's very difficult to distinguish between a real account, a real user in the real world, and something that's operated by a foreign country. But fortunately, you know, your response can be fundamentally the same, regardless of whether it's a real user or not. And that is, you know, we want to be careful not to retweet someone just because you happen to agree with the hashtag that they're using. Be careful when you're communicating with anonymous accounts. But also, just as important, we want to make sure that we're not dismissing somebody else or attacking somebody else and accusing them of being a Russian troll just because we happen to disagree with their perspective. I honestly believe that's been one of Russia's biggest impacts on American conversations is, you know, it's easy to just dismiss somebody now for being a Russian troll when really, we just don't like their ideas.
And can I add something?
Yeah, go for
can
it,
I add
Patrick.
Something to that? I think that we have this old idea that the right question you should be asking yourself when you're thinking about sharing something on social media is this true or not? Now, obviously, that's an important question. You shouldn't be sharing things that are not true. But there's another, I think, question that's important to ask, and that's, why am I seeing this, and who am I helping by sharing it? When you retweet something or when you share something on Facebook, you're kind of doing two things. You're spreading an idea, and that's the sort of true and false stuff. Like, is this a true idea or a good idea that I'm sharing? But then you're doing something else, too, which is that you're raising the prominence of someone or some actor. If I retweet you, your ideas get out there, but you also get out there. And I think you need to be careful about who you're getting out there. Who are you raising the prominence of? And do you really know who this person is, or is it just, you know, some generic photo on Twitter that you think you know what they, but actually, you know, once you stop and think about it, maybe you don't even know who this person is at all.
That's the level of the individual. Now, Patrick, how about social media companies themselves? As you guys have mentioned, they sometimes delete these troll accounts, but it sounds like a game of whack-a-mole. Could they be doing more to stop the spread of these kind of messages?
I think they could be doing more. I think they are doing more relative to what they were doing in 2015, 2016. I think that some of the things that get put forward, like things like political advertising bans, I'm not very enthusiastic about those sorts of measures. They wouldn't have done anything to this Russian intervention at all. They weren't using political advertising whatsoever. I think that some of the steps they've been taking on Instagram, affecting the degree to which you can basically raise the prominence of other accounts are useful.
And Darren, as we wrap up, social media is a pretty new form of human communication by historic standards, and it's constantly changing. I mean, is this just a new reality that we're always going to be vulnerable to this kind of manipulation in an ever-changing environment?
Yeah, I mean, you're making a great point. This sort of manipulation isn't new. It's been in different forms for generations, but social media has really lowered the cost of entry for bad actors. I think we're going to see more and more homegrown disinformation, not just state operations. I've already seen more of it in my work. So, I think this is a new reality if we, you know, really change the fundamental way we interact on social media.
We'll leave it there for now and keep watching this story. Darren and Patrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Darren Linville is an associate professor of communications, and Patrick Warren is an associate professor of economics at Clemson University. They talked to us about their research into Russia's professional internet trolls and how positive social media posts are a big part of those disinformation campaigns. Coming up, our guest tracked the devastating impact of opioid drugs on one high school graduating class. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, over 200,000 people in Wisconsin may need to re-register to vote in next year's presidential election. We'll look at Friday's court ruling on a voter registration lawsuit. First, the high school graduating class of 2000 is getting ready for its 20th class reunion next year. But in some communities, the anniversary may be a painful one because of the impact of opioid drug addiction and overdoses. Our next guest dug into the stories behind the statistics by talking to members of the class of 2000 at an Ohio high school at the center of the opioid problem. Dan Levin covers American youth for the National Desk at the New York Times. One of his latest pieces is headlined, "The Class of 2000 Could Have Been Anything Until Opioids Hit." Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you, Dan, to Minford High School in a small town in Ohio?
So I've actually been reporting from that county in southern Ohio on the Kentucky border for much of this year and looking at the impact of the opioid crisis on children. You now have a generation of children who are growing up with addicted parents. And over my time there, I met people who were in this class and were telling me about what happened to them in high school and since. And it became clear to me that this was more than just a few kids, that the scope of the opioid crisis was incredibly pervasive, not only in this community, but in this school in terms of how many people have been affected. So that got me thinking, how do we tell this story? And I was able to get a hold of the yearbook. And so that's kind of how we framed this.
Yeah, you tried to reach out to all the students you could find in the class. I think you ended up with just shy of half of them over time. And I want to look at some of the stories you heard. What were people saying about their first encounters with opioid pills in their high school days?
So you have to kind of go back in time to the mid-90s. This is a class that entered high school in 1996, the year that OxyContin was first introduced by Purdue Pharma. And before that, you had teenagers who would go out drinking maybe around a bonfire. But some of these classmates were telling me that they started doing, snorting, swallowing pills, various painkillers, and didn't really know what these were. They just knew that they got them high.
Yeah, one of the students or the former students looking back said, "We didn't know we were doing heroin." I think it seems like if you'd told them, "Hey, these are heroin pills," it might have been a different story.
Yeah, I mean, they really had no idea. They didn't know that these were opioids. They didn't even know what opioids were. This is a very small town. It's pretty rural. There had never been any overdoses, nothing like that. And you were having kids who were going to parties, and they'd be on plates crushed up. You had kids who were doing them in school on the back of on their desks. I heard from classmates talking about kids were using baseballs to crush them up and snorting them behind a propped up textbook in the back of class.
And you talk to a wide variety of students. I mean, this is the athletes and the honor students and just the everyday kids. This is something that didn't just affect one particular group within the school.
Yeah, I mean, think of it almost like The Breakfast Club or Clueless or this kind of iconic high school scene. And all of a sudden, this very dark force came in. And they're teenagers. So you have members of the basketball team. You've got kids in the Bible club, across the high school world. And people were doing it, and then they got addicted.
Talking to Dan Levin from the New York Times about his reporting on a high school in Ohio at the center of the opioid epidemic, some people call it. He talked to just shy of 50 students from the graduating class of 2000 there. And Dan, from all the quotes you have from all these students, and you show what they looked like in the yearbook and today, everybody had a connection, whether they did pills themselves or had a loved one who died or had ended up with somebody's raising their niece or nephew. Everybody had a connection, it seems like.
So, yeah, I spoke to almost 50 people, 49 people, and 15 of them said that they had become addicted to drugs. 36 have family members. 10 have gone to prison or been arrested for crimes involving drug use. And this wasn't just kids who were partying after school. I talked with people who were prescribed opioids after a car accident, for example, and that's how they became addicted. It really kind of ran the gamut. And it was just kind of devastating to hear the impact of this over the last 20 years. I mean, you have some who became seriously addicted to all types of drugs, who went to prison, who've lost family members, I mean, close family members. I talked to one woman whose brother was in this class, and he died of an overdose a few years ago. There were actually three kids in this class who ended up dying due to their drug use.
I want to focus on one story, somebody who's trying to help others now deal with addiction, Jake Bradshaw.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible, incredible man. He was one of those who started using opioids back in high school. It was in the party scene. He was quite popular. And over the years, it really spiraled into serious drug use. We're talking about heroin addiction, cocaine, just all types of drugs. And he's really turned himself around and started a Facebook blog called Humans of Addiction that has hundreds of thousands of followers. He also runs The Addict's Diary, which is another Facebook blog that has around, I think, 800,000 followers. So, you know, he's really been trying to humanize what addiction looks like over the last generation. And he's also working in the recovery industry. So, you know, he knows what this is like, and he's trying to make change.
And something that comes out of looking at it, as you did, Dan, looking at this whole high school class, I think we hear a lot of stories about the individuals who have been affected. In this reporting and some of your other reporting there in Minford, it's affecting a whole community.
Exactly. I mean, it's a small community, but even if you zoom out to the county, really it seems like everybody knows someone who's dealing with or has dealt with addiction. It's in families. You'll see entire family trees where addiction has taken root. It's shocking, actually.
And then in some of your other reporting, and this is just tragic just to say it, a generation later now, schools there are having to teach their, you know, kindergartners coping mechanisms if their parents are addicted.
Exactly. So a lot of these children are coming to school having experienced extreme neglect, physical abuse, other kinds of abuse, and they're getting to school and just don't have the psychological and behavioral abilities to function. So you'll have educators at these schools, and certainly in Minford, talking about how it's hard to even get these kids to learn to read because they're so behind and they're so traumatized. So now in Minford Elementary School, they have an entire program where they're teaching children how to deal with trauma. They're teaching them about how to essentially meditate. They're teaching them how to process anger. They're teaching them how to make emotional bonds. In many ways, they're doing the job that parents traditionally have done because there's really no other option in order to get these kids to succeed.
We talked about Jake Bradshaw a little bit. I believe there's another story from one of the students in the class of 2000 who hadn't been involved in drug problems then but is, you know, working with kids today. Do you see people from the class of 2000 there and others in the community being part of the solution now?
On some level, yes. You have members of this class who've gone on to become teachers and other professionals who are, if they're not directly trying to help the next generation in the classroom, are advocating. Their families are advocating. There's lobbying going on, I think, from the grassroots level. And hopefully that will make change. But this is obviously such a huge issue. It takes more than just one community.
Yeah. Looking at this problem, this nationwide problem with opioids through the lens of this one community in one county in Ohio, do you get the sense that things are getting better in the last 19, 20 years?
Well, I think now there's obviously a recognition of what the problem was. A lot of these families get criticized for not knowing and not dealing with their children's addiction 20 years ago. But as one parent said to me, we didn't know what this addiction looked like. There had not been this kind of pervasive flood of opioid prescription pills before. And so now I think there is a recognition. There is more of a kind of rehab landscape, but I don't think it's enough. This is where policymakers and funding, I think, has to fill in those gaps. And you see that at these schools where they don't always even have the guidance counselors trained specifically to deal with some of these issues.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Dan Levin for joining us today. He covers American youth for the National Desk at the New York Times. He joined us for a look at his piece on the impact of opioid drugs on a Midwestern high school's graduating class of 2000 and his other reporting from rural Ohio. This is it, the moment I had feared. According to Billboard magazine, the number one song in the country this week is Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. The 25-year-old song hits number one for the first time ever. J. Carlisle Larson loves the song as much as I don't love it. Hey, JC.
Hi. I think it's funny that you've been dreading this, whereas we have been waiting for this. This is a very joyous time for fans of the song. This is the best Christmas song. I'm going to go out on a limb and just say it.
Now, I respect the song. It's well crafted. It's got a really good chord progression, a catchy melody. I don't know what it is that drives me nuts. Make the case for it. Turn me around.
Well, I mean, this came out, what, in like 1994?
Correct.
Like, height of Mariah Carey. She is now a legend. You know, I don't know what it is, but it feels timeless. It doesn't feel terribly 90s about it, so it feels like it could have come from any time. And I don't know, I've been listening to it for the entirety of my 30 plus years on this planet, so very pro. Also, fun thing I learned, she apparently wrote it in an hour and a half.
Wow,
which I think
bad.
Is kind of crazy.
Well, it starts an annual tradition in my household around November. My kids start singing it to try to put it in my head. Well, I'll take the chance and put it in my head. This is Central Time,
yes,
on the Ideas
yes.
Network.